This is Interviews with Technical People with John Robertson
and James Savio,
a podcast where we interview technical people in STEM fields
to discuss the past, present, and future from their perspective.
And one quick announcement. The announcement is basically that probably we won't have an episode released next week because I'll be out of town, so we just won't be able to record one.
And I'll be off the grid.
But fear not, we'll be back the following week. Today, we are joined by Devel Johnson. Devel is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, New York, New York, Weather Forecast Office in Upton, New York, where he is the Marine Team Leader and the Decision Support Team Leader, and is also a part of the Tropical Team. Day in and day out, he strives to help government officials and the public become more aware and better prepared for hazardous weather. Devel, welcome to the show.
Oh, that's great, John. Thanks for having me. So right off the top, I just wanted to say that I'm here on my own time, not currently representing the Weather Service. And for any official Weather Service information, please check with your local weather forecast office at weather.gov. So, but this is great. You know, I'm a longtime listener, first time caller, so it's great to be on.
I'm so happy that we're finally at the point where we have longtime listeners. And I guess. This will be episode 11. So it's 3 months or so. So yeah, great to have you on, Devel. Thanks for joining us. So why don't we dive right in, Devel? Why don't you tell us what is it that you do in your own words?
Yeah. So I guess the way I'll answer this question is I'll start by talking a bit about the National Weather Service and then the local offices and then what I do specifically. So the National Weather Service is a federal government organization. We're under NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is under the Department of Commerce. So the National Weather Service is made up of 122 different offices and 9 national centers. And our headquarters is in Silver Springs, Maryland, which is right outside of Washington, D.C. And just about the National Weather Service, everything we do is a function of our mission. And the National Weather Service mission is to provide weather, water, and climate data, forecasts, and warnings for the protection of life and property and the enhancement of the national economy. So everything we do is in focus to that mission. So all these local offices that they have around the country are pretty much co-located with one of the major cities. So like the New Orleans office is actually in Slidell, Louisiana. The Los Angeles office is in Oxnard, California. And like this one here, the New York City office is in Upton, New York. So
interesting. So that is the office that serves New York City.
Yeah. But it's not just New York City. We also cover Long Island, we cover northeastern New Jersey, the lower Hudson Valley, and southern Connecticut. So it's not just that one specific area, it's like the surrounding region as well.
I would say a lot of the offices cover, 15, 20,000 square miles of land or something like that?
Yeah, about 150-mile radius, give or take. Okay. And some have multiple states that they cover as well. So we're one of those. It's like a multi-state office.
Would an office typically be near population centers, or is it more to cover land? Like if there's an area, say out west, with a lot of land but not a lot of people, are you still going to have a high density of centers or not as many?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. It really first, it comes basically on the distance that the radar covers. The radar is, it can cover just about 150-mile radius. So typically, that's where each one of the offices is located, about that far away. And 9 times out of 10, that's near one of the major cities. So, and it doesn't have to be. There are offices that are in smaller cities, especially like our Wyoming offices and offices in like North Dakota. They have like a lot more area that they cover, but that's kind of typically the case.
So what is your, I'll ask, what is your role there? And then I'm also curious, what is the role of each site as far as what they do?
Yeah, so specifically at the National Weather Service. I am the Marine team lead and the distance support team lead. And so as a Marine lead, our office actually covers quite a bit of water as well. We cover out to 40 nautical miles, and we also include the Long Island Sound and the New York Harbor. So with that comes a lot of Marine partners, so the U.S. Coast Guard, Department of Transportation with all the ferries, and the New York and New Jersey harbor operations. So working with them, making sure they get an accurate forecast, going to those meetings virtually now, and then making sure that they have all the updated information. And so as the decision support lead, the National Weather Service, we have this whole concept of impact-based decision support services. And what that is it's the process of us helping out government partners with their weather information. And so as these decision support team lead, I make sure that our process in helping them out, and our email briefings that we send out, our webinar briefings that we do, is done smoothly, and we work things out that way.
What is the output of your team? Do you send out forecasts or models? Yeah. You mentioned emails.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of things that go on at the weather forecast office. So so typically at the office, so we do the 7-day forecast, which is our public forecast that goes out, the temperatures, maximum temperatures, the wind speeds, dew point, sky cover, all those things like that. We also do specialized forecasts, which is the marine forecasts, so wave heights and swell period, things like that, rip currents. We also forecast for fire weather, so the fire conditions that are out there. And we also do aviation forecasts. So we provide the forecast for the FAA and all the local airports. We have 9 airports that we forecast for. And that's the general idea. We also do all the warnings and advisories for the area. So those alerts that you get on your phone, the warning polygon that you see on TV, that's coming from our office.
Interesting. So like the severe storm warning, that's the one I see a lot.
Yep.
And interesting.
Tornado warnings, hurricane warnings, all those, they come from us.
Yeah, are you individually putting those out and helping put those out?
Yeah, so I can go into a little bit of detail about that, and I'll help the audience visualize. So on the operations floor, there are typically 4 desks that are staffed. There is the public service desk and observations desk. So that's the one that releases the weather balloons in the morning. We do that twice a day. They also check the climate data and QC all of our observations that come out. They also handle public calls and social media, things like that. We have the aviation desks, which is they're the ones who's doing the aviation forecast as well. And then there is the short-term forecaster, which is they work the first 36 hours of the forecast. They're also the ones who puts out the hazards for the next 36 hours, 36 to 48 hours. And they're typically the one who may or may not be working the radar desk. There's severe storms out there as well. We can go into more detail about that later. And then there's the long-term forecaster desk. And they go from anywhere 36 to 48 hours out to 7 days working on the forecast.
Wow. There's a question that we wanted to ask, and I feel like now would be a good time since we're still pretty early, but I feel like you've covered some of it. As I just wanted to ask Devel, like, what is meteorology? It sounds like it encompasses a lot of things. You're talking maritime, information for pilots, and all sorts of things. Like, how would you define meteorology?
I was gonna say one thing I'd like to point out, kind of a distinction, is, you know, recently we were talking with Dan Smith, who's a classmate of all of ours, and you know, he's more of, you know, spreading it out to the public, you know, broadcast. I think, you know, what is meteorology, but also how do you see it differently than he does?
Yeah.
As well.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. So I'll start with the, I'll start backwards. So we love our broadcast meteorologist partners. Like those are, they're fantastic. The National Weather Service, our main focus is government to government support. So supporting the Department of Transportation, the Coast Guard, all of our local emergency managers. That's our main focus, as well as serving the public as well with our products that we put out. But the broadcast meteorologists, they're the ones who are able to really, they're the ones that the public sees and is able to talk to. So we love our broadcast meteorologist partners. And so that's kind of what the National Weather Service does. We focus on government to government support there. And as far as meteorology, and it's basic, but it's complex. So it is the study of weather. And that leads to the question, so like, what is weather? Which is basically the transfer of heat and moisture from the equator to the poles. And normally that's an easy process, an easy diffusive process that happens. But because the Earth both spins and is tilted, that process becomes a lot more complex. And we see that resulting phenomenon as like the weather that happens from your day to day.
And as you work on, I mean, it's more than just heat moving through the air, but you have to deal with heat coming off the water and going into the water and
so
whatnot.
This is like a really interesting question then. So let's just say the Earth was a perfect sphere and it wasn't tilted. You know, it was completely symmetric. Weather predicting in that case would be a lot simpler, right? And it was totally flat, right? No mountains, no valleys.
No oceans.
No oceans, right? It's just totally uniform.
Yeah, it would be like that. And the one issue there is the sun. You know, the sun would be constantly producing heat on that sphere. You know, mm-hmm. So there would still be some temperature differential, and that would so the one of the basic things about meteorology, and it's a concept that everyone I feel should learn, is that temperature differences cause pressure differences, and pressure differences create the wind. So once you kind of internalize that mantra, things start to make a little bit more sense as far as meteorology is concerned.
This is a side question, but I had to get it off my chest. So if meteorologists study the weather, what do you call people who study meteors?
Astronomers?
I guess. I feel like we should know
not
that.
Sure. Yeah. Geologists? Space geologists?
Yeah.
I feel like they don't even have a name. The meteorology took the name from them.
that's one of the funny things about meteorology, you know, studying things that fall from the fall from the sky.
According to Wikipedia, meteorology comes from the Greek the study of things high in the air.
The study of things high in the air. All right.
Meteoros is things high in the air.
This is real-time data collection. This is fantastic. I wanted to get your take on this question. It's interesting because you're now the second meteorologist that we've had on the show, but I know you... Correct me if I'm wrong, Devel, but I believe when you first came to college, you started out as a physics major.
Yeah, I did. It was astronomy and astrophysics major.
There you go. So we were excited because we knew that you kind of spoke the same language as us super physics nerds. So
yeah, I love it. I love it.
I wanted to ask about weather modeling and why it's so difficult, and not to say like you and your team aren't doing a good job, but just the awareness that it's a very difficult problem to do long-term weather modeling. I mean, like even when we go like a week out, it's like it's subject to change, let alone a month out, right? We cannot predict with that amount of accuracy, right? Whereas like the stars, we can predict where Venus is going to be like a million years from now.
Yeah.
With pretty good precision, right? Like, why isn't weather forecasting like that?
Yeah, because it's a complex process, and we're lucky enough that actually the weather is solvable numerically. It's a system of 7 equations with 6 unknowns. So it's an overdetermined system, meaning that those equations can be solved and you can produce output and forward in time. So we're lucky enough that we even live in a physics world that where that's possible. But the reason why it's hard to predict very far out in advance is because of it's three basic concepts. The first is that we have imperfect observations. We don't have a thermometer everywhere. There's not one in my room. There's not one in your room. There's not one that's everywhere outside. And also, the atmosphere is a layered fluid. So there, not only are we missing observations everywhere at the surface, but upwards in the atmosphere as well. So we have a system and network of observations, but it's not everywhere. So those initial conditions that we put into the models are difficult, are hard to obtain.
Is that why you mentioned the balloons that are launched from your site?
Yep. Okay. Yeah.
I never even thought of that. Even if we were to cover the whole Earth with thermometers, it's still only one layer.
But if you cover the whole atmosphere with thermometers.
Interesting, which is impossible.
Yeah. But. And not just thermometers, hygrometers, anemometers. We need all those initial conditions to go into the equation. So because those are imperfect, that's your first source of error. The second one is the equations themselves. The equations themselves, and we can go in more detail if you want, those are imperfect. They have certain assumptions. And so because of that, they're very accurate, but only to a point. If you were to take, and this leads into the third concept, you take two models with similar initial conditions but slightly different equations, you run them out past 5 days and you start to see significant spread, and it gets into that concept of chaos theory, where it just takes one little change in the initial conditions that'll change the final forecast. So again, these models are very accurate out 3, 5, even up to 7 days. And we have models that run up to 14 days. And that data that we get out, that output is still useful. You can get certain anomaly trends that are useful for forecasting purposes, and it gives you an initial heads up. But like I said, it's because of those imperfect initial conditions, imperfect equations, that leads to the model spread that we get further in the forecast. And that's a problem that's unique to meteorology in a way.
Can you kind of break down what you mean by the 7 equations and 6 unknowns?
Yeah, definitely.
I feel like that's kind of a strange concept for a lot of people. And what those equations and unknowns are.
Yeah. So your winds going east to west, going north to south, going up to down, so the X, Y, and Z direction. So that's your first three. Your fourth one is the equation of state, which is your PV equals NRT, if you remember that one. So that from chemistry, that relates temperature to pressure to volume to density in a way. So that's equation number four. You have your sources and sinks, which is your rain. So rain entering the atmosphere through evaporation and then leaving the atmosphere through precipitation. Not only that, it's advected east to west, north to south by moisture is moved through the wind. And then, so that's equation, let's see, what is that, number five. Number six is your temperature equations, which is, you know, the heat coming from the sun, warming the earth, and then that heat itself is moved left to right, up, down, north, south, in the same way moisture is moved just by the wind. And then your last equation is your continuity equation, which basically, if you think of the air like air in a balloon, if you were to squish it, that balloon would still move up and down and expand kind of in that one direction. And it's this concept, it's one of the assumptions there, that air is incompressible. And that way that you're able to kind of move, once you move the air in one direction, it comes outwards in other directions. Even though we know that incompressibility of air is an incorrect assumption because of basically sound. The reason you can hear me is because of pressure waves, you know, so that's an example there.
I love that proof point. Like the fact that we're talking to each other is an example that air can compress.
Yeah, so that's just one of the assumptions right there.
Example of the equation's kind of flawed, but that's generally is pretty good.
But it's okay. Little side tangent, but we physicists, I often like to say that like what a physicist does is make assumptions. Like we list out assumptions and then use that to maybe feed into some calculations. But there's one assumption.
And I assume that's what a lot of your models do, is you start with those basic assumptions and then just start slowly tweaking things from there, where you get more precise data.
Oh, definitely. And like, those equations are basic, but at the same time, there's other parameterizations and, of course, computer modeling. Those things, they're so advanced now that they kind of compensate for any of those assumptions that are lost. But again, because they aren't exactly perfect, that's one of the reasons why we have what we have.
And I think you pointed out there were 7 equations and then 6 variables, correct?
Yep, six variables.
Okay. And I think I can guess a couple of them. One was definitely temperature.
Yep, one's definitely temperature. James, do you have a guess for one?
Wind movement.
Yep. Yeah, wind's another.
XYZ coordinates.
Yep, so those are, let's see, so it's 1, 2, 3 for XYZ for wind. And then we had, you said temperature. And so there's also, precipitation, moisture is the other one. And let's see, the last one is a bit harder. It's pressure. So pressure is one of those things. Yeah. So those are the 6.
Okay. So
which pressure is not something I think about. It's not something I look for in my forecast, but I remember hearing about it on the TV all the time from the meteorologists.
Yep. So. When you see those highs and low pressures, that's solved by the computer modeling.
But it's funny, that's another proof point that air does compress, right? Because there's different pressures. So it's like there's different assumptions in different parts of the model where it's helpful.
yeah, in a way, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Cool. And it's, when we frame it like that, like what our equations are and then what our inputs are, it's clear to see, or we can now think about, okay, we don't, like you were saying, we don't know the temperature at every location. We don't know the pressure at every location, precipitation. Yeah, but that's basically I like breaking it down into those fundamental components, because then I think where the complexity comes from is, okay, now spread that over the entire Earth or even a region, and it gets very complicated.
Does
the model include surface features of the Earth, for lack of a better terms, mountains, valleys, oceans?
Definitely. Those are all included. If you think of it, and this helps for a nice kind of thought experiment, there's 2 different types of models. The first one I'll get into a little bit of detail, and the second one I'll kind of leave for outside research. But the first one is just think of everything as a grid space. So let's say the GFS, which is the Global Forecast System, it's the American model, it has a grid space of 13 kilometers. So think about like every 5-6 miles or so. And so that box, that's just a box. And those boxes are spread out throughout the entire Earth, throughout the Earth. And that's the grid space.
Just to put that in other words, I think I understand what you're saying is like we have to deal with like meshes in physics.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of sounds like that. Or like the listeners can almost think of it like a pixel, right? Like that is your That is your smallest division of data.
Yeah.
So like you'll have one. So that's, what was it, 13 or 16 kilometer?
13 kilometers.
Box. Yes.
We'll have one temperature. That is basically uniform everything based on how the model looks at it, right?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And yeah. So, it's one of my favorite things to tell students when I'm giving presentations. It's like, you or I, I'm smaller than 13 kilometers. So to a model, we don't exist in that type of way. We have to be parameterized and averaged out for that one grid space. So, yeah.
But what about, maybe there's a different answer for this, but what about what about certain features that maybe can affect weather, but are smaller in dimension than 13 kilometers? Well, you think
I think of the city I live in is about the size of that grid space.
Yeah.
Yep. But we've got a deep valley with a river at the bottom and hills on either side. And I know that the hill is going to get more snow and it's going to be, a different temperature in the valley, but you're still just kind of, for your big model, just kind of running the assumption that it's pretty much the same, or?
Yeah. So, we don't just have one model. So we have other models that have smaller grid spaces. Exactly.
Nice.
We have models that are, say 3 kilometers, 9 kilometers, things like that. And so those features start to come out. And as we get better computing power, that's one of the ways that we can improve our forecast, is by increasing that grid space. But remember, it's not just one grid. It's their boxes, because we are vertical in the atmosphere as well. So the instant you increase that grid space, you're also increasing the volume, and you see, that can just ramp up your computing power by a lot.
Yeah. It takes a lot more time and a lot more computing power when you just,
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can we go through an example? There's an example I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah, sure.
And it's a relevant example for us Californians. Still feels weird calling myself a Californian. But there's this weather event that happens like clockwork every year that we call the Santa Ana Winds. And my super basic understanding is there are winds that come from the east, which is rare. And so if you picture California on the map, that means they come from the very, the Arizona, California, super dry desert. And they come and they're fast winds and very low humidity. And the reason it's relevant, especially right now, is because they often lead to forest fires, wildfires, because the hot, dry wind just fans the flames. But anyway, that's about what I understand about the Santa Ana winds. Can you explain why they occur, or maybe how they occur, or?
Oh, yeah, 120%. And I can't talk about the Santa Ana winds without giving a quick shout out to our incident weather meteorologists that are out there. So those are the ones who get deployed to fires. And so the California offices, they know fire weather like the back of their hand. So I can't talk about those winds without giving a quick thank you to all those people who are working so hard out there.
Shout out to all of them. Great.
Yeah, definitely. So for as far as the Santa Ana winds are concerned, you have to remember that when those winds are coming from the east, not only are they dry from the desert, but they have to go up and over these mountains. And one of the things that happens when it comes down the mountain is as air goes down, it can be compressed and warms up. So it can warm and dry even more. So as it goes up the mountain, it might lose some of its moisture as it goes into, higher in the atmosphere, and then it comes back down. And as it's coming down, it compresses, it warms, it dries, and it can flow through canyons that will kind of act as channels, and those speed up the winds, and they come through Los Angeles and the other valley cities. Very fast and very warm. So that's how it is in a nutshell. So the key is that there's a term for it. It's called adiabatic compression. And that's the concept of air coming down and warming as it comes down.
I remember it took me a couple semesters in college to finally understand what adiabatic changes were. That was one that took me a while to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
What does adiabatic mean?
Yeah. So we have in meteorology all these thought experiments, and I'll give you one. So you think of the air as a parcel. I like to think of it as a balloon, but you can think of it as a parcel of air. So adiabatic means that in that balloon, there is no heat transfer. It's just whatever is in the balloon is what's in the parcel. So there's nothing going in and out. So you make this assumption that there's no heat coming from the sun and that there's no like temperature loss coming out of the balloon. So if the balloon expands, it can cool just in the same ratios as that PV equals NRT equation. And so when it compresses, it can warm. And so that's one of the kind of assumptions that you can make about the atmosphere to help you visualize and conceptualize meteorology.
So adiabatic compression, the air comes over the mountains and then
so you're saying it warms as it comes down. As it goes down the mountainside, it warms and compresses as it comes down the mountain.
Why does it compress when it goes down the mountain? Shouldn't it gain volume because there's no more mountain in the way?
No, it's because it's coming down and getting to a higher pressure. So it's coming, say, like 850 millibars, which is around 1500 feet. So if it comes down in the atmosphere, it's going from 850 millibars to, say, the surface might be around 1012 millibars. So that increase in pressure, if you go back to your equation, is pressure is related directly to temperature. So as the pressure increases, the temperature increases. How it happens.
I see. I think I was thinking about it the wrong way, but what you said just makes sense. Like just how when you climb a mountain, it's lower pressure. When your airplane is lower pressure. So while it's up there, just because of the altitude, it's lower pressure. But it's still the same, for lack of a better term, number of air molecules. And then when those air molecules go down on the other side of the mountain, they're higher pressure.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay. Got it. I have a follow-up question.
Go for it.
So it sounded like what you just described, like the wind going up and over a mountain and then an adiabatic compression on the leeward side, right?
Yes.
The far side. I feel smart when I use these words. So it sounds like that's just a general physics thing, right? That's what happens when air flows over a mountain.
Yep.
So the reason Santa Ana winds are the reason they like gather attention, one of the reasons, I guess, is because almost every other day of the year in California, the wind flows in the opposite direction. It comes in from the west, from the ocean, and then flows from west to east. Is that why the desert is so hot to the east of us? Because the adiabatic compression is also occurring on the east side?
Oh, yeah. That's one of many reasons. So, but as you said, normally the wind will come from off the ocean and act kind of as a cooling effect to, say, Los Angeles, because you can kind of get into this whole idea if you've ever seen a sea breeze. So when the land warms, it creates this natural low pressure over land. And the ocean doesn't warm as quickly, so there's a natural high pressure over the ocean. So you'll get wind coming off the high high pressure going towards the low pressure, so from ocean to land. So that's your kind of sea breeze. And that's one of the reasons why you'll get that westerly wind typically. But occasionally you'll have a, say, high pressure system that forms over Nevada. And if you think about how this high pressure is, the winds around a high pressure system rotate clockwise. So when they come back down, they go through the desert, and then over the Sierra Nevada, and then coming down into the coast of the California coast. So it takes a unique set of factors to get the Santa Ana winds.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have another question, but James, you haven't asked a question in a few minutes.
Well, I've been kind of thinking about this earlier when we were talking about the grid size and then the Santa Ana winds. And
right. Exactly.
I know that you, Duvel, have worked for you worked for a different office before you were in New York. And one of those things is when you move to the new office, I'm sure there's these geographical quirks that you have to learn, these weird valleys. And then you've got, mm-hmm. you know, where you are, you're surrounded by water on lots of sides. And growing up, you know, nearish the ocean, I understand that having the ocean nearby really changes things a lot. I don't know if you can comment on kind of that.
Oh, definitely. I was really nervous moving up here initially because I lived, and we'll talk more about this, but you know, I've lived in Florida and then New Orleans and Alabama, so I've always kind of been in the South. So when I moved up here to New York, I was worried that something would be like amiss. But nope, thank goodness, physics still works the same up here. And
that's important. Yeah, physics still works.
So as a native New Yorker, people are very nice in New York. It's a stereotype that people are like whatever rude in New York. I'm sure you found it. New Yorkers are awesome. Just saying.
Yeah, New Yorkers are really nice. You definitely don't want to walk slowly in the street or anything like that. But other than that, they've been super helpful to me. So moving up here has been like a cool experience to learn both the meteorological quirks and things. So that's one of the things is we were taught very well at Florida Tech, and so I was pretty comfortable once I started doing the forecasting and working up here that okay, thank goodness the physics still works the same. I can do this. So.
One thing you have to deal with a little more, though, is something I know fairly well is snow, and we've mm-hmm. got fun things like nor'easters.
Yep.
That's where I am in Maine. That's the worst weather we get is snow and nor'easters. Mm-hmm. But you haven't had to deal with that down south.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, like when you have those systems, these nor'easters. Well, in meteorology, we'll call them like mid-latitude cyclones, and they're these storms that can strengthen very, very quickly. And so the good thing is that occasionally we get the same thing that'll happen down south. You'll get a system like that that'll the pressure will lower, and you get just one of these strong low-pressure systems that move through. And so it was cool to kind of experience the same phenomenon, but in a different location. And once when you get the storm happening up north, you get colder temperatures. We're right near the water, so you get the water coming off the Gulf Stream up here. And that temperature difference. Remember, the temperature differences between the water and then the cold land can create these strong systems. So that was such it's been a cool thing to experience like firsthand up here.
And that's another example of the physics is still the same. The temperature and water and moisture presence are just a little different this time.
Yes. Yeah.
Nice. Nice.
I have so many questions, but like, I want to throw you one that I didn't think of this until just a minute ago. Can you tell me why the Coriolis effect is what it is? Like so what I generally know is because of the way the Earth spins, the storms in the northern hemisphere rotate a certain way and storms in the southern hemisphere rotate another way. And it seems like magic to me.
But also that it really doesn't affect your toilet.
No, it definitely doesn't. So it's an interesting thing that once there's kind of two things that you need for the Coriolis effect to be important. So the first one is that the system has to be large. So large scale systems are affected by the rotation of the Earth. How large? On the order of magnitude of 1,000 miles. About 1,000 miles. So that's what we call synoptic scale features, mesoscale features too. Sorry, I'm throwing out these terms. Synoptic scale would be the size of a country. Mesoscale would be about the size of a state. So they have to be pretty large features to be affected by the Earth. So does that mean that
a smaller feature, like for example, a tornado, is not necessarily impacted by the Coriolis effect?
Exactly. That is one of the things that's a test question right there that you would have nailed. So yeah. So that's one thing. And then so slower features are affected by the rotation of the Earth. So the slower the feature is, the easier it is for the rotation of the Earth to need to be accounted for. So that would be on the order of magnitude of about 6 hours, so like a quarter of a rotation. So if some weather phenomenon takes about 6 hours to occur, then you'll have to kind of take into effect the Coriolis effect. So
besides hurricanes, what else fits that description of being sufficiently large and slow?
Yeah, we mentioned one, nor'easters. That's one of the things there. You'll have the jet stream is another that's affected by Coriolis. And you'll have these systems called mesoscale convective complexes, which are these large complexes of thunderstorms that they last sometimes on the order of magnitude about 6 hours. So things like that can also be affected by Coriolis. But to explain what the Coriolis effect is, because the Earth is spinning, if you want to go from in the atmosphere from a point in the equator to the poles, you have to remember that the Earth is spinning beneath you. So in that sense, your location will have moved under you, and you have to think about that when you're flying planes. Or the way they found out, or really kind of learned more about it, was when they were shooting missiles in like World War II. So it's like, oh, your target moved because the Earth is moving under it. Same thing happens in the weather.
They get me thinking, it's kind of unrelated, but does the atmosphere have kind of a shear force from the Earth moving? The weather system's there, but the Earth is kind of moving under it. Does it? I don't know.
My initial inkling is not quite because the whole of the atmosphere is kind of moving together a sense, but the other kind of response is yes, there is wind shear because the atmosphere is a layered fluid, so winds at the surface can be moving a different direction than winds aloft. So yeah.
But when we see my mind is trying to comprehend when we see like a hurricane rotating, in some sense it's partially not because it's moving, but also impacted by the fact that we are moving relative to it here on this big spinning ball that we call the Earth.
Yes.
And so from our perspective,
And so you can think of the atmosphere in kind of like two different ways. You can think of the atmosphere without thunderstorms in this kind of like inertial state, then where there's nothing really happening, and that atmosphere is moving, you know, with the Earth, and everything's moving together and everything's just fine. But once you have some type of special feature that or phenomenon that happens, that's when you start having to think of like the Coriolis effect and other phenomenon that happen that need to be accounted for.
Okay. That's really helpful. There's another question that I wanted to, and I know we have like, we also want to get to the part about like how you got to where you are, but I want to take advantage of having an expert in these. One of the fun things about weather is everyone interacts with it. And so it's in one way, it's very comprehensible to everyone because we all, you know, see the wind blowing.
Okay.
This has just been on my mind a lot recently. So when I am looking at a weather forecast, it'll often say, for example, 20% chance of rain today. Does that mean there's a 20% chance that at some point today, any point today, it will rain? Or does it mean that at any given instant, there's a 20% chance that it'll be raining?
So it's the first one, but I have to get into a little bit of detail.
Okay.
So, yeah. So it's the chance that you'll have rain in a given time, in a given time period. So typically with the weather service, when we put out our precipitation forecasts and our POP, the probability of precipitation, that's done at a 12 hour. So in a 12 hour time span, that's what you're seeing typically on like the, on our site. Of, so taking a step back. So when a person like me is working on the forecast, we use two different things. We use on one computer monitor, we'll have what's called AWIPS, which is the Advanced Weather Interactive Processing System. So that's where we see all of our model data. That's where we're looking at all our observations and the radar and satellite and things like that. We can see that on one monitor. On the other monitor is what we call GFE, which is the graphical forecast editor. So that's where we are legitimately, you know, so it's a grid space here that we're looking at temperatures and wind and gusts, and that's where we take the model data and create the forecast. And so what I'm saying all that to say is that the forecast grids are 2.5 kilometers each. And so in each one of those grids, if you were to go to our website and click on your city, you'll see a little box. And that is what you're seeing as far as the temperature for that location or the precipitation forecast for that specific grid spot over a 12-hour period.
So when I see like the hour by hour on my phone, is that kind of in that 12-hour average, or has that been broken down a little more close? And also, like, you know, sometimes I see like a 30% and it's misting out. But like if it's a hard rain, I'm probably going to see a higher number.
Yeah. And yeah. So it's a, like I said, it's a function of both area and confidence. So when you're looking at it, you say you have a area, you say, okay, so 30% of this area is going to be affected by rain, and you have, say, let's go with a 50% confidence. So you multiply like 50 by 30 and you get 15%, and that's the probability that you're going to see at that specific area. Now, when you're looking at the hour by hour, that's a different calculation, which I can't quite remember off the top of my head. But what it does is, you, as long as you're looking at it at that hour at that location, that's what you're seeing. So say if you're saying if on a given day, if you're seeing a 40% chance of rain at 12 o'clock, then 40% of the time you should see rain at that area. Sometimes it's raining and that's good, you know, sometimes it's not. But over the long run, every 40% chance day should see rain 40% of the time.
Okay. And I got another follow-up that I wanted with that is like, so I get my phone or I get my weather mostly on the app for my phone. I also do mm-hmm. follow my National Weather Service office on Facebook as well. Cause they're great. Mm-hmm. But like,
that's awesome.
The forecast I'm seeing on my phone, does that come from you guys? And like the stuff I see on TV, does that come from you guys? And like who's using your data?
So you can think of us as we're like the base, and other private companies, they might use the weather service forecast as part of what they eventually go out to the public. So a lot of phone providers, they might have AccuWeather. So AccuWeather, they make their own forecasts. I'm sure the weather service forecast is like one of the parameters that they maybe base things off of, but they don't have to use our forecast. And okay. The same thing goes for broadcast meteorologists. Like you said, Dan makes his own forecast. I'm sure he watches our stuff as well. But he would probably use some of our data as like maybe a starting point. And it gets more complicated than that. So, yeah.
But you said you have a lot of government groups that like directly contract yes. with you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They come to us and they check our sites for all their, like the kind of the weather, their weather needs.
Okay.
I have another question, and this could be another, like, this could be a whole episode, but I have to take advantage of the fact that you said you do marine forecasting as well, right?
Yep.
So I think I use some of those forecasts as well, because naturally I go out to California and what do I want to do? Go surfing all the time.
You did that in Florida too.
I wasn't as good in Florida though. But okay. That's a different story.
Yeah.
So me and my surf buddies were constantly looking at buoy data.
Yep.
And we're trying to understand, and you know, we have our own like way of, and not me, but like the surf community, they have their way of translating the buoy data into like what will the size of the wave be. And the basic idea is there's like the swell height and period. Mm-hmm. So it'll be like 2 feet with a 18 second period, and based on those numbers we can try to crunch. Surfing is surprisingly math heavy for everyone who doesn't know. It actually is. Can you speak a little bit as to like how that buoy system works and how it's forecasted? Because I know that it's forecasted like weeks out as well, in a way that actually seems even more accurate than like the general weather forecast is like the buoy data or the wave data. Anyway, can you just speak to that for a little bit?
And I want to make that question a little more difficult for you too.
Sure, you can go for it. I think I can handle it.
Where I come from in Maine, the marine forecast is more about fishing. We've got like, you know, fishermen, lobstermen, and they're worried about swell. We also have to worry about 10 to 20 foot tides. And so, you know, John's interested in a recreational thing, where I am, it's economical. So yeah, there's a lot of considerations to take there.
I think that's more important, but you know, we both just want to know how big
the waves are going to be.
Oh yeah, definitely. So like I said, as the marine program leader, like our marine partners, from surfers to fishermen, they're all important. So when we
you hear that, we're important.
Yeah. So when we're doing, before I get into this, I'll do a quick meteorology lesson. So winds and waves, the waves, for the most part, are generated by winds. So the stronger the waves, the over a longer time period, I mean, the stronger the winds over a longer time period, the higher your waves. So that's why when we do our coastal water coastal waters forecast, which produces the wave heights that you'll see, that's part of that comes under our umbrella, because you can't have waves without wind. Well, I'm sure you can, but that we'll get into that on another day. But for the most part, you can't. Waves are generated by the wind. So to answer your question about the buoys, so we have the National Buoy Data Center, which is part of the National Weather Service, and they have all these buoys all over the place. And so one of the things, like you said, they look at is swell height and swell period and wave height as well. And so the thing about waves is that their period is conserved. The energy of a wave is conserved, and that energy is directly related to their period. So if you have a long period swell coming
closer. What do you mean by period?
Oh, so it's just like any type of wave, the time it takes between one wave crest to one wave crest. So you'll have, this is a fun thing to do. If you go to the beach, you can count the seconds between waves, and more often than not, they're going to be just around the same. So it's really neat. And that's basically what the buoy is doing out there. And so if you have a buoy that's counting the waves, and it says, okay, this wave has a 12-second period, that's pretty high. And so by the time, but a swell height of like about a foot, by the time that same wave gets to the coast, it's going to slow down. When it slows down, that the energy of the wave has to be conserved. So as it slows down, it gains potential energy by becoming higher. So it changes that one kinetic energy to potential energy by going higher in height. So that's how we can, one of the ways we can tell the waves over the ocean what they'll be like by the time they get to land.
Okay, real quick, can we just clear up what's the difference between swell and a wave?
Yeah, so swell is basically waves that have been generated far off. They're coming from something that happened, say like a hurricane. Like a hurricane might be out in the Atlantic. It will generate waves where it is, but those waves move faster than the hurricane itself. So the waves will get to, say, a buoy before the hurricane does, and that's what it calls that swell. While at the same time, you'll have winds near the buoy that will be generating waves on its own. So you have both the swell plus the waves, and that'll give you your total wave height. And just to loop back around to James's question, the other thing that's included in that total wave height is the tides. So the tides, you have those three things that happen. You get the swell, the locally generated waves, and the tide on top. And so that all goes into the wave height forecasting.
So, and that's interesting, because when I'm looking at these, like what goes into a wave, what will often be provided is there will be multiple swells simultaneously in different directions with different periods, different heights.
Yep.
Then all of those interact with each other to make the wave that we see at the beach. And that's kind of one thing that I actually had to like learn as a surfer, like, oh, like there's these different swells interacting with each other. And like, for example, sometimes there'll be like two swells that by themselves aren't that big, but if the angle between them is correct, they can create very large waves on the beach. Some of these interesting. So that was actually very helpful. So there's those waves, which are like the local event, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, the wind created. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the swells are these like traveling energy packets of water. Maybe that's,
Yeah, it's one way to think of it.
You
can think of them just as waves that were generated somewhere else.
Is a tsunami a specific type of swell?
So
different altogether.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I always think of is that tsunamis are deal with earthquakes. So that's geology. That's something completely different.
Okay.
but at the same time, when you have something that happens, say some type of geological event, a tsunami can travel from a long period, a long way away. In the same way that swell can travel a long way away. So they're okay. Different, but not entirely.
Okay.
The energy of the swell, is it a surface event or is it like the entire depth of the ocean or how far down does it go?
Yeah, that's another equation that I can't remember like off the top of my head, but it's throughout the, it depends. It depends on the wave. It could be throughout the entire column, or it could be just half the column, and that depends on the wave itself. So
got it. Okay. Before we take up your entire evening, we should probably ask some of our more standard questions.
Sure, go for it. Yeah,
we always want to get around to. Can you tell us? And I like to think this is helpful for anyone who's like curious about how people get plays of careers. Like, what was your path to get to your current position? It's starting as far back as you want to go.
I said we knew you as a physicist, and then you you changed in college, and here you are now.
I did. Yeah. So, I like to kind of start with like my mom and my dad. So my mom was a geologist and a natural scientist. So she had been working in that area. So I've always had earth science on the brain. And then my dad was a engineer. He's still an engineer. So I've always had kind of this mathematical mindset. And not only was an engineer, but he was also a fisherman. So fishermen, they look at the weather all the time. And so that weather had always kind of been in my background. I'm originally born and raised in New Orleans. So by the time I was around that 12, 13 age, we had a little known storm called Hurricane Katrina.
I remember that one.
So, yeah.
So it was pretty devastating for my home city to say the least. We're lucky enough that we had a two-story home. So our first floor got completely flooded and had to be rebuilt, but we still had the second floor. And that can be a bit of a long story. So I'll, if you have questions, I can go into more detail about it. But one of the things that was really interesting at that time was that all the power was out. There was no power for the city. For a long period of time. And so when I would go home after school and, you know, you wait till night, you can see so many stars, like so many. So that got into my brain about me wanting to be an astronomer and working with astrophysics and just kind of hoping to one day kind of study the stars in a more like scientific mindset, because I had always been one of the things that has been close to me. I wanted to help people with science. That's probably like, I was probably like maybe 3 or 4 years old when I realized, okay, helping people with science is what I wanted to do. So,
by the way, that is an incredible story that during the power outages post Katrina, you were gazing at the stars, which you could see now because the lights were out and thinking these things. I mean, that is, whew.
Yeah, it's one of those things that like I grew up in the city, so you don't see stars. I mean, I had been to the Louisiana countryside, and I mean, I've seen stars, but like that, not there, not at that spot. So okay, so that's like 13 years old. In high school, I had a great stats teacher, my homeroom teacher, who was a meteorologist in the Air Force. It's a great guy, Mr. Quirk. So he taught me a lot. And so meteorology had been in the background, but it wasn't like my focus. So when I, by the time I got to college, I went to Florida Tech, Florida Institute of Technology. So with you, John, and James. So
that's a great school, by the
absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely.
It was fantastic. So the way I even found Florida Tech was that I searched three things. I searched meteorology, I searched astronomy and astrophysics, and I searched accounting. So those are the three things that I was interested in. And
I don't remember the accounting program, but I remember the other two quite well.
I know some very successful accountants who came out of Florida Tech. That's a real thing.
Yeah. So, you know, in a search function, and Florida Tech was just one of the schools that came up. And so when I enrolled, I was an astronomy and astrophysics major, and I loved it. I mean, that's how I met some of these names that you're going to know. You remember Carly, Bev, Perry, and all those fun people, Rachel, stuff like that. As an astronomy and astrophysics major, and then going to the Student Astronomical Society meetings and stuff. That was fun. And so that was all my freshman year. And so, okay. So I had a great time as an astronomy astrophysics major. So what made me switch? So I know you guys remember Dr. Olashade, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We need to get him on the show. Dr. Yeah,
he'll be on the show one of these days.
Expect a call from us.
So I remember that Perry had been, I got to shadow her and a couple of other, astronomy majors as they were doing one of their night viewings, looking at white dwarves and trying to, you know, get calculating the age of white dwarves and things like that. So I thought that was super fun.
Was that one of their?
With the big Ortega telescope, the one on the roof?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So
it'd have these all night shifts, I remember.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So I got to shadow one of those, and I did love it. I did love it. But I had one of these realizations where, you know, I love astronomy, I do, but it was slow. You know, things are, this time scales are literally astronomical. So I wanted something that was more high paced, and something that I knew I could help people and still stay in science, and I still wanted to do that. So I decided I wanted to switch majors, and meteorology had always been there. You know, it had always been a part of my life. And so when I switched majors, I didn't look back. You know, that was one of those things where I switched, and I had met all these great people, and you know, it was really fun there.
And
so
the school had a really good meteorology program, because I took a couple of classes as well.
Yeah, with Dr. L and Dr. Lazarus and Mr. Split.
Yeah,
and I was just fortunate enough that my junior year, it just so happened that the National Weather Service office was in Melbourne, Florida. I had no idea.
It was 2-3 miles up the road from the school.
Exactly. Our Met 101 class visited the Weather Service office, and I you know, fell in love with it. It was really neat, really high tech, really sciencey. And I asked one of the warning coordination meteorologists for his business card, and he said, "Oh yeah, contact me, send me an email," and I did. So that's how my junior year I was able to start out as a volunteer, and then at the Melbourne office. Then in the summers I would volunteer at the office back in New Orleans, which was actually in Slidell. It's a city that's about 15-20 minutes north. And so volunteered there. Eventually there was a Pathways internship that I got at the New Orleans office. I was able to continue that internship through my undergraduate year, and into my master's that I got. I got my master's degree in meteorology also at Florida Tech. And so once that internship ended, I had had an initial offering to go to Houston, but because of for lack of a better word, government, like kind of bureaucracy, that fell through. But they had an opening that was right at New Orleans's sister office in Mobile, Alabama. So that's where I went. I worked as a meteorologist at the Mobile, Alabama office for 3 years, and that was awesome. It was great. Wow. Great work in there. And so at about year two, I started we used the phrase like bidding out, because at the time, one of the ways that you could get an advancement in the meteorology in the National Weather Service was to apply to other offices, because your specific office might not have an opening. Like I said, it may seem like a lot of offices. I mean, there's 122 offices, but there are only a certain amount of openings at a certain office. So
I would say there's not a lot of people there, and they probably stick around for quite a while.
Exactly. So if you don't bid out, you're likely to stay at your office until an opening opens up, or you just stay where you are in that current level. So I went and I applied. I applied and got so many rejections. I applied to the Atlanta office, got an interview, and it worked out pretty well. But they just have to go with someone else, you know. And then I applied to Houston. I applied to I got an interview for Houston. I applied to I applied to several different places. And so one of the places I applied was the Upton office up here in New York. And I had an interview. I nailed that interview. And so now I'm here. So that's it. That's kind of my journey in a nutshell. So yeah, it took a lot of work, definitely, to get up here. And it was a process, but it was well worth it.
Amazing.
What advice would you give to a young person who's interested in doing what you do?
Oh, just please, please, please be proactive. I don't know where I would be had I had not just asked for that that business card and had followed up with the office to get that volunteering opportunity. And so one of the things you can do is just make sure that you're keeping in contact and trying it, not waiting for the opportunity to come to you. You have to go and find it, because it's out there. If a person's interested in meteorology, there's so many aspects of it that you'd be amazed. So you can go into the public sector, you can go into the private sector, you can go into research. And in each one of those sections is thousands of different job opportunities. So don't wait for those to come to you. You have to go to get them, because they are very competitive.
With your field particularly, and maybe the world beyond, what makes you most excited about the future, and also what makes you most concerned about the future?
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. So I think there's two things that make me super excited about the future. So the first one, well, pre-COVID, I would have said the most exciting thing is like the model upgrades that are coming up. So like, I think either next year or maybe a year and a half from now, the American model is going to get a pretty big upgrade. It's going to go from 13 kilometers to 9. And it's going to go from like 64 vertical levels to 128. So that's really good. So that's going to be really good for the forecasting aspect of the American model. So I think that's going to be that's something to be excited for.
Where is that modeling based out of? Like, who owns that?
Oh yeah, that's let's see. That's run There's two servers. There is a supercomputer that I believe is in Florida, and there's one in Virginia. I'd have to double check on that. But yeah, there's these big server rooms that run the models. I think, yeah, here it is. It's Orlando, a data center. That's in Orlando, Florida, and another system that's in Virginia. Then those two combine to run all the models.
And is that programmed out of the National Weather Service headquarters?
We have one of the national centers is the National Center for Environmental Prediction. They're in Boulder, Colorado. So
okay.
Yeah, ooh, that's nice town. That's where. Yeah, it's awesome. I can't wait to visit. So in a nutshell, I would have said pre-COVID, I would have been like models and that. But now what I'm most excited for is really the outreach and getting back out into the community. That's one of the things that I miss so much. We do these Skywarn classes where we go out and we teach people about meteorology so they can then take observations for us, because meteorology is an observational science. The more people we have helping us with obs, the better our forecast can be, and the quicker we can get the warning out to people. So general talks at high schools and middle schools and things like that. I miss that. So I'm really excited for that to come back. And then we also do like our deployments to emergency operations centers. So we're there. And we're there for the emergency managers to help them in person. We have to do all that stuff virtually now. So that's okay. It still gets the job done, but I'm really excited to try to get back to that. So that's one of the things I'm super excited for.
Quick side question on that. You noted that meteorology is an observational science. Is it a thing for lack of a better term, like normal people to like contribute, whether it's observations or things like that? Is there a system for that?
Oh, definitely. So there's ways that you can call the weather service. You can let them know if it was a heavy rain event that you got this much rain at a location. We also have the COCORAS, which is our, I forget exactly what it stands for, but it's our community like rain network, where people will report their observations. So they do rain, they also do snow. And there's, we have other systems where people can like kind of link up their temperature sensors and their anemometers, and we can see that data. And all that stuff is super helpful, because the more information we have is the better for us.
And I know it's not as dedicated as much, but my local National Weather Service office, when we have a snowstorm, they'll just put out on Facebook, you know, what town do you live in and how much snow do you get? People will just comment, I get a few inches and I live in this town, and it's another way for them to collect data.
I like that.
Yeah. Cause all that goes back into, we have a concept called verification. Which is, so we put out a forecast, how well did it verify? And we need observations to verify that. So that's the more we get, the better we can kind of fine tune things for the next weather event.
Right.
Huh. Yeah.
Great. And well,
I guess,
yeah, go ahead.
Oh, so I didn't. So the other thing. So what am I kind of most concerned about?
Yeah,
and that would be, I think it would have to be like science literacy is one of the big things for me. Is I would love for everyone to know kind of those basic physics concepts and internalize those ideas, because I think that that'll help people think about when they see kind of science in the field, that you can't trust every scientific paper that you see out there. You can't trust everything you see on the internet. But once you get an idea of science literacy, specifically with weather, it's like, it's not the 1960s anymore. Like our forecasts are very accurate are accurate enough for you to make life-saving decisions. So long story short, it's like trust the forecast, trust the science, and if you have any questions, you can always just ask. You can call the Weather Service office. You can read our forecast discussions that we produce every day on our websites. And if there is an aspect of the forecast that you don't understand, we can always clear that up for you. And so that science literacy process, it's great because it's a back and forth. It's not just us giving out the forecast. It's also us trying to receive feedback for it.
And you mentioned you do outreach, right? Or at least you used to do more outreach before COVID, yeah. I suppose. Mm-hmm.
So what I hear there is concern, but also kind of hope in the same breath where, you know, you're worried, mm-hmm. but we're happy to teach you and talk to you about anything.
I also think podcasting really helps too. I think
it does.
Podcasting with experts is a way to reach a new audience.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
Put that out there.
Yeah. I'm very hopeful for the future of the National Weather Service and just for science as a whole. We have a whole host of stuff that we're going to be learning about and trying to improve on. So I think we're always improving, and I think we're headed in the right direction.
With that, I want to ask my not even my favorite question, but unquestionably the most important question.
Yes,
I think we should point out that while Duvall is not at all a New Yorker, he's now in John's backyard.
That's right,
being in New York. But anyway, go ahead, John.
So Duvall, you shall have a very informed answer. What is your favorite pizza topping?
Okay, so I'll do the simple one, and I'm a pepperoni guy. So I like pepperoni pizza. It's the one that I will get probably 98% of the time. The other 1% might be I'll get something like a margarita pizza or a cheese pizza. But it's pepperoni is not my favorite topping. My favorite topping, if I can get it, is shrimp. So I'd love if you can get shrimp. Yeah. I'm Louisiana born and bred. If I can get shrimp on pizza, I would love it.
This is what happens when you take someone from New Orleans, Louisiana, and put them in New York. You get shrimp on a pizza.
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever had shrimp on a pizza.
You're missing out.
I definitely have.
Do you have the whole shrimp, or do you like cut it up into small pieces?
No, it's like the whole shrimp, but you get like smaller ones that you can put on the pizza. There's places in New Orleans where you can get it. It's not like, again, it's not common. You won't see that a lot in places. That's why 98% of the time I'll get like a pepperoni pizza. So
here's the thing, Duvall. I'm a little bit of a pizza purist. So I like cheese pizza. But for the audience, in case anyone doesn't know, I lived in New Orleans for a solid 5.5 years, and I found every pizza place in the city. And I don't even remember if they had shrimp pizza. I would have just blocked it out of my mind. I didn't just see it. Shrimp doesn't go on a pizza. But now I will go and get it. Do you happen to remember if Pizza Delicious had? Have you been to Pizza Delicious?
I've definitely been to Pizza Delicious.
That was my go-to spot.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to Pizza Dominica too on Magazine?
I went there once, but they were too high class for me. Like,
yes, they
had like nice pizza. it was too high class for me. I had to go to the little corner shop and get my
slice.
Mid-City Pizza too. Anyone who's listening might have no idea what we're talking about. These are the main pizza places in New Orleans. That one I actually thought had the best New York style slice in the city. Mm-hmm.
I'd have to agree. I definitely am a fan of Mid-City Pizza, but I think Pizza Delicious, because it's near to like the park that's over there, and I kind of really like that area. So
the Rusty Rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and anyone who's going to New Orleans, do yourself a favor, go to Pizza Delicious and
see if they got shrimp.
The thing with Pizza Delicious is they tended to rotate out their menu. Like it was constantly changing what their toppings were. So it was hard to like get a. It was always changing, but anyway.
Yeah.
Wow, that is probably the most one of the most unique answers we've had.
So I'd say. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. One more question, Devel. For any of our listeners out there, let's just say any of them wanna follow you or just get more information. Anywhere you would want to point them to?
Yeah. So I'm on pretty much all the major social medias, but for Twitter, they can follow me at DA_VLJ. Or on Instagram, they can see Ace of Life as my Instagram. And I mean, if they want, they can find me on LinkedIn too. Just search Devel Johnson, and that's how they can find me. But like I said at the top of the podcast, I implore everyone to go to weather.gov and search for their local office and follow their local office and get all that information there. Because their National Weather Service is open 24/7, 365, and we're always there to kind of help out the people. So go to
there's always someone at the office, right?
Yep, always.
Yep.
Fantastic. Wow, this was great. To our listeners, thanks for hanging in there. This was a fairly physics heavy episode, so let's just all thank Devel for his time. Thank you to the National Weather Service for all that
you've done. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks, everyone.